Okay, so I have no financial relationships to disclose. All right, so the main focus of this talk, of course, is on longitudinal data. And one of maybe the main or most important points is to realize that longitudinal data sort of offer something that cross-sectional data do not. And what that is, generally speaking, is they offer a direction for causality. They don't necessarily, they aren't say that one variable causes another, but once you start studying variables over time, it allows for the possibility that one variable causes another, something that you really cannot look at in cross-sectional studies without making some strong assumptions about what's happening over time. So longitudinal data in this context provide a really unique opportunity for documenting links among important outcomes over time. And really, from what I've seen with the researchers I work with, oftentimes, for example, in research grants, we're just trying to make a case for a particular link between two variables. It really is often developed in a longitudinal manner. That's usually the most convincing manner of developing that link. Turns out there's a variety of analytic methods that you could use to analyze longitudinal data. And still nowadays, some of the more common approaches are what are known as repeated measures, analysis of variance, or MANOVA. And these have been around for a while. They were developed back in the early 1900s. Sort of the first methods for analyzing longitudinal data. And while they have their advantages, they also have their disadvantages. You could see this as an advantage or a disadvantage. What they really do is they help you understand population-level data over time. So you can, for example, track means over time for the whole population of interest. You can track variances as the variance spreading, is it shrinking over time, are people becoming more or less similar. And you can look at correlations. Are people which is typically the case, less highly correlated as time goes on, or do the correlations more or less maintain over time? These are the types of questions that you can address with the regular or the typical repeated measures and ANOVA-MANOVA approaches. The main disadvantage, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that what these approaches don't allow you to do is focus on individual change. And that's really, hopefully you'll agree after my talk here, what many researchers are after is focusing on individual change and trying to talk about what's happening at the individual level. Just a very brief, quick summary of some of the background on individual change. Although the idea itself has been around a little longer than I'm showing here, really the formal sort of papers on the topic of individual change came around the 1980s, and they really developed in disparate fields. We have biostatistics, psychology, education, educational psychology, and that's really where individual change started to become a prominent sort of focus in the methodological literature. One reason for showing this slide is to sort of make the point that methods really sort of develop slowly over time, at least in terms of their application. Methods that have developed in the 1980s, really still, they're used, you know, relatively often, but they still are not really, I would say, the mainstream methods for understanding these data. So a good 25 years later, but at least I think most methodologists would say are the methods you should use, are still sort of around, and they're still sort of becoming part of the methodological toolkit that substantive researchers will use. In some cases, individual change could be assessed on one outcome variable, and this is very commonly the case in a randomized clinical trial, where you have to have some primary outcome. You may have secondary outcomes, but even then, you're going to have that one analysis that much of the trial is going to rely on. And still in other cases, there's going to be cases where I think multiple variables might be of interest. And this will be more true when you're conducting a prospective observational study. So this might be a situation where you're trying to sort of set up a scenario where you can then say, I want to have an intervention, or you're trying to sort of make a case for an intervention that you could, for example, send a grant to NIH for. So in these cases especially will be the focus of this talk, these prospective observational studies where you have relatively large samples. I mean, it depends, what's large depends on the particular context, but this is where you can begin to look at see if variables are changing together over time. And when you're looking to see if these variables are changing together over time, the type of modeling approach that I'm going to talk about are multivariate individual change models, so the MICMs. And they're really the best models, at least as far as I'm concerned, to use in these cases. I mean, maybe there's some special cases where you could use other approaches, but they're really the primary approach of use. And you'll sometimes hear these models called parallel process models in the literature. And the idea is that because you're following the process of change in parallel, or in other words, across the same time frame, for the variables of interest. And this could be two variables, three variables, et cetera. Just depends on how many variables are, you want to consider outcomes in your model as opposed to predictor variables. And of course, the advantages, two of the main advantages of the multivariate individual change approach is that you'll get a complex but still comprehensible understanding of the public health outcomes of interest, and it really provides way of thinking, you'll get a number of advantages over traditional methods. And what's some of these sort of advantages are, one, you can look at individual change over time and separate outcomes. So if you have multiple outcomes, each of these, for each of these particular outcomes, you could look at change over time. You can also look at associations among rates of change. And this is one of the main advantages of the multivariate approach over univariate approaches. You could say, for example, depression is changing over time. That might be related to glycemic control, for example. And if they're both changing over time, that and the changes are sort of in the right direction, as glycemic control, for example, worsens, then depression worsens, well, you're making a strong case for that link and then intervening, for example, on depression to then possibly change glycemic control. So that's another main advantage. And you can also look at patterns of change at both the average and the individual level. So the repeated measures ANOVA, MANOVA, you can look at patterns of change on average, but you can't look at patterns of change at the individual level. So this is where these models can be used. There's also other ways that you can use these models, which are especially the mediation sort of out of the context of what I'll talk today, but you can also look at bidirectional effects. So there's different questions you can address with these models that you just couldn't begin to think about with repeated measures ANOVA and MANOVA. So just to give you a general idea of what an individual change model is, basically what you're doing is you're constructing a model where whatever variable you're interested in is being modeled as some function of time, usually a very simple function like a linear function, maybe quadratic, plus some leftover. So there's some component that if you're modeling the individual's data, you can't account for just because of the fact that there's no reason to think that anybody's going to change perfectly according to a linear model or a quadratic model. So here's an example of the typical model, which you could call it a linear model. Some people call it a straight line model. And in this context, one of the key foci here is that we have an I parameter or an I subscript. And what that means is that people can have their own parameter values. That's really one of the main benefits of the individual change approach, is people can start at different places, excuse me, which is almost always the case, but they also can change at different rates, which is an important part of sort of the analytic process when trying to make the case for having the links among these variables. And then, more or less, this individual change approach is going to, going to be to use these parameters, the slopes and the intercepts, as outcomes. For example, you might want to predict your rates of change according to demographic variables, maybe insurance status, whatever variable might be of interest. You could, at a person level, you could use to predict whether people are starting at certain points or changing at different rates over time. And just a little bit about the error term. So I said the error is more or less what's left over, and it turns out this can be just quickly made up of a few different components, one being measurement error. So depending on the type of variable you're studying, I work in behavioral medicine where a lot of the variables do have a great deal, at least some measurement error, so like a depression inventory, so like measuring the CDI. Measurement error here is just the fact that the variable is different from the true value because you aren't measuring it correctly. That's it. It's not because the variable really is different than what you're, or it's not because that the value of interest is correct, it's just that it's incorrect. The idea is that inter-individual variability means that you have a value that is different from the linear function, but it's real change. So inter-individual variability, for example, is due to the fact that, say, blood pressure fluctuates, right, on a daily basis. So you're going to have these fluctuations even though there's some average value. So these are real differences or real values, whereas the measurement error is sort of not real. It's more the fact that you get a value and it's just wrong. The final piece of this is model misspecification, just because when you fit a line, even if that seems like a reasonable model, it's not technically going to be perfect. So some of that will go in the error term. Some other assumptions for what I'm going to talk about is that your outcome variable is quantitative, more or less quantitative, so you're going to treat it as though the values sort of have some quantitative meaning. Turns out you don't have to have that. There's other models you can use that allow you to model probabilities over time if you have an event outcome, or if you have a 0-1 scenario. But so the same sort of ideas apply. A couple other points that are more measurement issues is that the measure of attribute has to maintain the same meaning over time. A simple example of this might be that a multiplication test measures quantability in second graders. It's probably not measuring quantability so much in college students, and maybe measuring attention to detail, whether they're really paying attention to the test. They more or less probably know their multiplication tables at that point. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And also the scale measure has, if it does change over time, you have to somehow equate the scales. So one example is here is Stanford-Binet is one measure of cognitive ability at early ages. The WACE is something you would use at later ages. And this is something that comes up in pediatrics actually quite often, where there's, for example, the CDI is the Children's Depression Inventory. Once they become adults, you have the BDI, and this is an issue you have to deal with. Here's just a quick schematic. You can see some of what the multi-level approach to change. The idea, without getting into too much detail, is that there's two levels. There's one level where you're modeling time at the individual level. More or less, you could say you're fitting conceptually a regression equation for each person. So let's say we got four data points for each person over time. We could think about fitting a regression slope for each person, and then using those slopes and intercepts at level two, and using some other predictors to understand what's happening for those intercepts and the slopes. Some parameters of interest include these fixed effects, the beta 0,0, beta 1,0, which are more like average parameters, or they could be like regressions. But there's also variability parameters that are of interest. So the variability in this B0i here is the variance of the slopes. In other words, people are different at the beginning of the study. The variance tells you how different they are. The same here, variance of the slope. If that's different from zero, that tells you there's significant individual differences in change over time. It looks a little daunting, but the multivariate individual change model is more or less the same as what I just talked about, with just more equations, because you have more outcome variables. So we have two variables now for, say, one person, and for each of those variables, we'll fit a straight line model. Then we have an intercept and a slope for each of these variables, and that's why we have all this sort of six different equations here, is because we have these two levels again, and all this information which is included. So more or less, you're fitting two univariate models simultaneously, in this case where we have a bivariate model. An important parameter that you don't get from the univariate case here is the correlation between the slopes. You get other parameters, but that's the one I'm going to focus on as being the most important, because that's where you're going to make the case that this variable is changing over time, the other variable is changing over time. If that correlation is high and there's a strong association, well, there's a good case for saying we should intervene on one variable to change the other. So that's the associations of change approach to using multivariate individual change models. Another way that you might use these models is in a bidirectional effect model. So what is this scenario? It's more or less the same. We have the same level one model. We're going to say people follow some model of change. It could be linear. At level two, it's a little different, however, because we're going to use the slopes as each of the outcomes and the intercepts as the predictors. Well, what's the idea here? The idea is to see if one variable is driving the other, or if they both drive each other to some extent, and if they do both drive each other, which might be stronger. So to the extent these beta 1y, beta 2y, beta 1z, and the beta 2z parameters are strong, let's say they're all strong, that's telling you that there's strong bidirectional associations. An example where there wouldn't be a bidirectional association would be, for example, if we look at the first equation here, if beta 2y is statistically significant, that's saying that z is driving y. But if beta 1z is not significant, that's saying that z is driving y is not driving z. You're saying that there's really only one pathway for these variables to work through one another. So that's where bidirectional effects can be useful for sort of delineating in a more complex fashion how variables are related and trying to make cases for their intervention upon them. So those are the types of models you can fit. And just to give you a better sense of how these could fit into an underserved population, I mean, I think just generally speaking, these models are good. Whether it's an underserved population just or a general population, you're going to get a lot of information from using these models. But particularly in underserved populations, there will be some cases where they could be useful. For example, you might want to determine if changes in quality of life might be related to changes in healthcare quality, where healthcare quality will typically be less in the underserved populations. And you can also expect that relationship might be strong. Furthermore, underserved populations could be compared in terms of average level. So if let's say that healthcare quality is lower in a particular population, you can compare that to another population of interest using these types of models. Another parameter of interest might be, we talked about the association between the rates of change. Well, that may differ depending on whether you're in an underserved population or not. It could be the case that your healthcare quality of life or your healthcare quality and quality of life are much highly correlated if you're someone who's in an underserved population, whereas if you're in a majority population. So there's, you can either look at these models just within an underserved population, or you could look at them in comparison to another population to show that there are, are these distinct differences by using the multivariate individual change models. To focus on one aspect of it, let's say we were talking about bidirectional effects, and this kind of goes with my example. We can assess bidirectional effects between depression and glycemic control and type 1 diabetes. But we could also see if some of these results depend on certain characteristics, your gender, your ethnicity. And if, again, if we have stronger associations between depression and glycemic control, we may want to tailor our interventions to these particular underserved populations to maybe focus more on depression, to make sure that these people are being treated properly if there is a stronger connection for a particular gender or ethnicity. And that's generally the idea here, is different treatment plans can be constructed depending on what type of a population you're in. And just to give you an illustrative example here, I have some data from someone I work with at Cincinnati Children's, Dr. Corey Hood, his pediatric diabetes and family study. And this is a prospective observational study where he's studying adolescents with type 1 diabetes, a chronic medical illness. And I'm going to focus on that, at least for now, as the underserved population of interest. He has four time points at this point. They're all about 3 months apart. Has about 150 participants. When you're using these models, this is more on the lower end, but it's still sufficient, I think, for our purposes. Very little missing data, which is a good idea in general. And we have three variables of interest here. So adherence, how many times, it's really at the average across a two-week period of how many times you're checking your blood glucose. A1C, so this is a measure of glycemic control. Higher values mean that you're not controlling your glucose levels as well as you should. And depressive symptoms measured by CDI, where higher values mean that you have more depressive symptoms. In terms of software, without getting into too much detail, the types of models that you could use depend on the particular multivariate individual change model, but in general, you can use structural equation modeling software. So I used M-Plus for these analyses, and that turned out to work out the best. There's other structural equation modeling software if you don't want to use M-Plus. There's Proc-Calus and SAS. There's EQS. There's a number of available software packages, but that's just something to keep in mind is the type of software you might need. And this is definitely daunting, I think, to look at, but this is just to show you the type of model that we're fitting. We really have three variables, and we have all these different parameters which correspond to these three variables. So we have a slope and an intercept, more or less, for each of these three variables. Parameters of interest are the mean changes, the associations between the changes, and the variability in the changes. So let's first focus on mean change, just to see what's happening. So it turns out A1C looks like it's increasing over time, but it's not statistically significant, so there's not much to make of that. Adherence is decreasing, and depression is decreasing over time. So this is information you could more or less get from a repeated measures of ANOVA or MANOVA. So I think it's still interesting information, but this doesn't show the distinct advantages of this approach. When you do start to see the advantages of this approach, however, are when you start looking at the variances of the slopes. And it turns out they're all statistically significant. So what does that tell you? The values that I showed you are averages, but they don't necessarily mean anything for a particular individual. You'll notice that 0.63 is the variability for A1C. Well, the average is 0.09. So that means we have some people that are about minus 0.5, which is one standard deviation below, and that are about 0.7 on the high end. So there's some people who are changing substantially, decreasing substantially. Some people are increasing substantially, something you couldn't get from repeated measures of ANOVA or MANOVA. The same is true for the adherence and the CDI variables. You'll see the standard deviations. They're both relatively large, saying that there's some people that are declining, some people that are increasing when you use these models. And what's probably, at least for my purposes, ultimately of interest here is to look at the correlations among the change. That's where the multivariate individual change model really becomes beneficial. And what we find here is that A1C and adherence are very highly correlated. It turns out this should be a negative correlation, so that's a typo. It's not the case that if you adhere that your glycemic control is actually worse. It's the opposite. And there's a very strong correlation, which really provides strong evidence for making sure people are adhering to their treatment regimens. to make sure that they're controlling their blood glucose. Also, borderline here was the relationship between depression and adherence. So there's also a borderline connection here saying that, well, people that are depressed may adhere less, and that's another link that we might want to focus upon to make sure that sort of in this way, you can sort of think of this as a two-way, two-path link where depression affects adherence and adherence would affect A1C. So we really get at these links, and you could get at these links cross-sectionally. It's not like you have to use longitudinal modeling, but the case is just much stronger when you use longitudinal modeling, which is why you want to use this here. So in conclusion, the models, generally speaking, provide much richer information than the traditional methods for the analysis of longitudinal data. And really, the reason for this is because the models allow you to focus on individual change, not just average change, which can be useful, but often you want to go beyond that level. And using the multivariate model as opposed to the univariate allows you to look at interrelations among different variables. And if you're looking for links between outcomes, this is where a direction you'll want to go. You want to look to see if two variables are related, not just that one variable might be changing in a certain way. And really, one of the main benefits, as you'll see from the as you hopefully saw from the illustrative example, is that you can generate hypotheses and really provide evidence for these links using these methods. Can be important for convincing scientific community that interventions are needed beyond, above and beyond cross-sectional studies. And really, we can focus on using these models to both look at the majority populations, but also looking at underserved populations to see if there are distinct interventions that we need to come up with to tailor to these people to make sure that they're getting the healthcare that they need. Okay, so that's it for that talk. Thanks.